This show is not for the easily offended. So if you are easily offended, go listen to something else.
All right, Steve. I may steal your intro, but otherwise, I think I have. I'm now recording. All right, fold back in. So again, I don't think anyone's going to be seriously offended, but we do put that warning on there. So if you are, you know to steer clear from our bad language. But speaking of bad language, what sort of comment? What are we bringing? I feel like Steve, as our guest of honor, returning champion, podcaster extraordinaire, you should stand in the circle of honor.
We paid his appearance fee again.
I read a few books, and that's really what's been keeping me from getting on, is that I've been just so busy over the summer, I haven't had a chance to really be reading enough stuff to be able to report on. And a couple of things. Number one's I checked out, and a series that I've long been meaning to check out and decided now is finally the time. I'll start with that, which is there's a TV show that in the States here, Kevin, premiered last night, and I DVR'd it but haven't watched it yet. But it's Greg Rucka's Stumptown.
You know, I thought about watching that, and then I sort of held off, and then I saw what time it was on, and I was like, yeah, I'll just save it for another night. Because if someone made some comments about something that made me leery of the way Hollywood produces TV shows sometimes.
I'm not watching the show, but I did get a chuckle that they were filming a scene at a local diner here. And I was like, yes, for once, they're filming in L.A. to make it look like Oregon instead of the other way around. So a little revenge for us Angelinos at our runaway production. But anyway, Steve.
I've never read the Stumptown stuff. It's been a blind spot. I mean, really? I knew what it was. I'm familiar with Rucka, and I've read plenty of Rucka stuff, and I enjoy when he's on John Suntress's Word Balloon and talks at length about stuff, and seems like an interesting enough dude. And they're always talking about Stumptown, and everyone seems always so fond of it and whatnot. Really? So it's like, you know what? I should check it out. It's been too long. And then I was actually already putting it on my read list, and then I heard about the show happening, and I was like, oh, that's interesting. And then recently heard Rucka talking about him being pretty happy with how the show was, and realizing that it's not going to be what it is on the page and has to be something different and blah 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 blah, but whatever. So I read the first volume. I guess there's three volumes of Stumptown, and the first one is that I read was the case of the girl who took her shampoo but left her mini. And it introduces a PI female, sort of down on her luck type of character, rough around the edges. You know, we've seen this type of character before. She has the additional responsibility besides staying alive, which if it wasn't for this other responsibility, I just don't know how even important staying alive would be for her. She goes through a lot of abuse that she seems to put herself right in the path of danger and pay for it. But she has a younger brother who is has Down syndrome, and he is a young adult and hangs out, and they live together, and he plays video games and snacks and things like that as sort of a person for her to greet and have interact with when she goes back to her apartment, that kind of a thing. But what's funny is that when she comes along all these different toughs, mob bosses and police sergeants and things like, everyone always, even if they're arguing with her over something, they're like, hey, how's your brother? Which is pretty funny. Everyone seems to have a soft spot for him. And one, a mob boss who runs a casino confronts our heroine with a ultimatum, because she owes like $18,000 in gambling losses. And she says, I'll wipe that debt clear if you find my granddaughter. and who's 18. She either ran off or was kidnapped or don't know, that kind of thing. But I know she was dating a guy. Who? I don't know, some guy. So that's all she's got to go on, and she needs to do it to wipe her debt clean. And, you know, just asking around and ends up getting into a situation with a family who is runs like the MI-13 in the Pacific Northwest, and realizes that she's in way over her head. She gets shot. She gets punched. She gets punched again in a different part of her body. She gets kicked. You know, it's pretty rough for her as she is continually asked to leave the case alone and stop poking her nose around. But she finds the girl and plays her cards right and manages to set up a deal at the end that seems like it goes bad, but she really had the upper hand, and she ends up being a kind of a Davy to the Goliath of the system that's around her, and comes out enough on top that makes the whole story a decent ride. And, you know, it was well-crafted, beginning, middle, and end. Didn't seem like it was drifting in any spot. I don't know how many issues the original was. It might have been like 3 or 4. It doesn't seem like it was more than that. But it had a good pace, and the art is Matthew Southworth, who has a sort of a... again, kind of a rough, scratchy, although he uses brush plenty, look, and the colors are pretty muted. It's noir, comics noir. But good stuff. The Stumptown is all right. I'm going to definitely read the other volumes and see where else they take this character. And check out the show.
I think that was during the time that I was reading a lot of Rucka stuff that I read these in issues when they were coming out.
I only read when they rebooted it, I read the first issue of the second volume.
Like, I didn't think it was one of my favorite things that Rucka has written, so I never picked up the second or the third.
Yeah, I think I was more, I bought a bunch of the Queen and Country instead. That was Rucka, correct?
Yeah, I haven't read those either, so that's next.
So I'm the only one that's read some of those.
Well, I read the Queen and Country once, but I didn't go in for the...
You didn't do the novels?
No, just the comics.
Okay.
I did, although it is funny that you talk about PIs, because as recent listeners know, I've been going through some of my old books to figure out what I'm doing, and I stumbled across the 5-issue series, also about a private investigator, but this is the second. I think, again, there were 3 of them. And this is the second one. I have all 5 issues of the Hawaiian Dick Screaming Black Thunder
version
from 2007. And that was B. Clay Moore and Scott Chandler with Stephen Griffin. But what's particularly interesting is, okay, the color work is a watercolor style. And normally that, I feel like that's usually done by the person that does the pencils and inks. But here it's done by Stephen Griffin. So it's kind of interesting, because they don't really follow the lines, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, there's a lot of thick ink lines for these characters, and the colors kind of don't always fill into the edge, or aren't always exact in that watercolory way. I mean, maybe it was digital, but it wasn't done in that way where you see, like, in Photoshop, where you can fill an area, you know what I mean? So I like that. Like, it feels like they just kind of painted over almost, or you could say, like, you could have almost seen the guy putting the colors down first and the guy drawing over it almost. So I like that the colors can, especially skies and stuff, can move slightly off tangent. And then in the back, there are also complete little shorts by the characters. Although what was weird is Stephen Griffin does like half of them, and it's a continuing story. So I read these all in one sitting, but I don't know if I would have been as thrilled. you know, if I'm buying this monthly, I get part two like 2 months, 3 months later of like a short. But it's, he's basically, the nice thing is they give you his, the summary of the case, because this is the second one, and it's Hawaii 1954. He is a former vet from World War II from the mainland who has relocated, and he has an assistant, Kahami, and local contacts within the force, and then the local gang scene. And, you know, crime lords and bosses. And it's the same kind of thing, Steve. The guy's down on his luck, drinks heavy. I don't know if, I don't remember if she drank heavy, but that kind of dangerous lifestyle. And it's the assistant that kind of keeps him from dying half the time. And this, the main story involves a squadron of classic fighter pilots show up and they do an air demonstration. But one of them gets shot down by a Japanese Zero plane from World War II, and they investigate it, and there's actually like a mystical connection, they think. And so they have to do a ceremony to get rid of it. But there's some vagaries. Like, I like that it's not as explicit about how much magic is in this world. Maybe there's none. Maybe it's just some weird coincidence. But I always enjoy that kind of line drawing. But again, if you want the PI who gets jumped and beaten up and always working just this side of the law and pulls that out at the end type of thing with the mystic twist, there's less of a intricate plotting in this one. But I will say they do continue a storyline from before about what happened when the crime boss he took down and the power vacuum that does not get resolved. So it's interesting, even though this is like issues 1 through 5, it feels like it's clearly set in this world, and this is from 2007, so it's like that Hellboy model, where they're kind of discreet, but they're kind of not. Does that make sense?
Yes, it's all part of one greater tapestry.
But they have individual little numbered runs, kind of. So this was 1 through 5. Man, when I looked at the price, I was like, $2.99. You know, this was a long time ago. But just beautiful, beautiful artwork. Like I said, I think the team is great, and those Stephen Griffin colors and his parts in the back are fun. I don't know if you guys had heard of the Hawaiian Dick series, but yeah, it was
I've read a volume. They weren't drawing the line, Andrew, at $2.99.
They might have been. I don't remember when. Wasn't it Hold the Line or whatever? I don't know.
It was DC's
efforts.
It was later. Yeah, I remember enjoying it, but then, like, the trade had, like, back matter, and one of it was, I don't know, things stick out to you, right, for whatever reason, and, like, the back matter was, like, sort of, like, rah-rah, indie comics, buy them, they're awesome, woohoo, type of thing, and I was like, that's kind of strange back matter, but anyhow, the story was good.
Yeah, I think that's the interesting thing about going back to these series. Sometimes I put my head space trying to remember, like, what were comics like in 2007? And I don't think they were as, I think the industry was coming back strong, but I seem to remember, like, the turn of the century, and correct me if I'm wrong, the comics were high quality, but I feel like the popularity and their central notion to the pop culture world and everything, I don't think was as strong. I mean, by 2007, it was definitely coming back. But I feel like now we're in, not just from a content-wise, but a perception-wise, like, the industry feels like it's in better footing.
Yeah. Like, I don't think you're at the image boom quite yet in 2007. I hope not. And you're also... There's several problems sort of around there with different aspects of the industry from what I remember.
Well, there was always
some of them not for this podcast. Like, I remember you had the whole manga explosion, and then it was sort of like the glut of like 1,000 books coming out, and then like took a dive at one point.
Well, I thought it dovetailed in with Steve's book nicely. So another fun PI. I mean, I liked it. I'm not going to give it an unreserved, because it feels like it's not pushing that stereotype Like, it's definitely within the trope, recognized tropes, and like, I didn't feel it was revolutionary or setting the genre on its head or anything like that. Like, I liked it, but it was solidly part of a PI tradition and nothing, you know, that post-war kind of stuff.
I think it had Recipes too. I think that's the one.
This Black Thunder mini, like I said, I think this was the second one when I looked it up. Didn't have anything in it, but maybe the first or the third
yeah.
one.
Yeah, unless I'm. But what are the odds that another book is going to have drink recipes and everything?
Well, I know it won some awards because I looked up Stephen Griffin because I wondered what else he did, and I don't think he did that much else. Like, I think this was kind of, at least according to ComicDB and the other stuff, I didn't see a big body of work like I was expecting from someone so clearly talented.
Yeah.
So always, but then that ties back into my whole thing about how, you know, even if you just do one series, you're always part of the comic book world. If you spend your Ramona Freyden and you spend your whole life in it, or if you just do 10 issues somewhere.
Yep. Eventually, Andrew will get to your book.
Sweet. It's time for the Black Hammer cast.
Ah.
Nope.
But feels not
already
here.
Nope. We already had that last episode. You'll have to wait. We have to have breaks in between Black Hammer, Kevin.
Okay.
New rule.
I read Black Hammer.
Did you read the last issue?
Well, this is how we're going to get you on the next episode, Steve.
Oh, there we go. I'll be back to talk Black Hammer.
He didn't even answer my question.
I read, I think it was the last issue.
Issue 12?
If not, it was the issue right before that.
Oh, okay.
Oh, yeah, issue 12 was the one that took a really long time to come out, right? Yeah, no, I have it, but I haven't read it yet.
Yeah, I kept on joking about how the crossover was three issues in, and we hadn't even had the last issue yet. They may have inadvertently spoiled something, or I may have inadvertently spoiled something. It was bound to happen.
Sure, anytime you speculate. I mean, that doesn't mean... I don't really think it's spoiling per se, unless you had...
No, but this...
Jeff Lemire was sending you script bits or whatever. You were just speculating based on what was presented in front of you. That's not...
But
people
it was...
do that all the time.
It's like the episode order of a cartoon was messed up on Netflix. So I had watched them out of order, but the way the series was structured is I couldn't tell until I looked it up online. Like the characters were walking through a city, and then they're like, oh, look at that weird thing that had happened over there. But they were looking at their previous battle, and I hadn't seen that battle. But originally, you were supposed to see the battle first. So I just thought it was them doing some out-of-sequence narrative thing, but actually it wasn't. So it kind of reminds me of, like, the Black Hammer thing. I'm like, would you have read it differently if you read the last issue before the crossover, or if you read the crossover first? Like, it's a different experience.
Oh, for sure. But I'm sure they didn't intend the last issue to take 4 months extra to come out.
But,
like,
I know.
I'm not reading the crossover till it's one issue from being done, though.
You might want to wait till it's done,
yeah,
Steve, if that
yeah.
last issue's on a 4 month delay.
But it's just funny now. Like, now I'm, since I read the last issue, I'm like second guessing everything because I read three issues of the crossover. So I'm all like, what would have my, trying to imagine what my experience would have been like. I don't know. It's weird. I did read other stuff though, just in case.
Because
I know Andrew is very runs a tight ship with the Black Hammer stuff.
Only with the Black Hammer. The rest of the show's a hot, digressive mess that never goes. So let's get to those other issues, Kevin.
I feel like more like Andrew now. Kevin read an anthology. So I'm going to refer to everything now. Doors. Not the Doors. Just to be clear. Although that would be an interesting anthology. They've had music anthologies. Don't think I've seen a Doors one. Usually some indie artist or something, right?
Hey, the Banthology books were all short stories about music.
But this one is about doors. Maybe literally, maybe, I don't know, metaphysically or some weird thing.
Who's the publisher on this thing? Is it some crazy indie you picked up at Cake or whatever?
Cake, yeah. I don't think it says a publisher. It just says it was created and, and published by the Donut Collective, so they don't really have an official, like, publisher.
Yeah, so this is something you just picked up somewhere. Cool. Is it regular size, or?
No, it's regular size. It came in a little baggie, though. Like a little plastic bag. I don't know. It's weird because I just noticed it has spine damage now. I don't know if I did that or because the cover is pretty thick cardboard. So I don't know if I must have done something at some point to it. It's kind of funny though. They have on the back praise for Doors, an absolute joy. I feel deeply understood. And then they say this is quote is from an actual Door. The experience left me unhinged. Another Door.
Ha ha ha.
Best thing I've been propped open with. Also a Door.
So it's a humor book.
I mean, in some ways. Like, I don't know if I want to spoil all the... Because, like, there's... What is it?
Give us something.
So it's wait, like, was that... Were those the funniest jokes?
No. But there's many, like... Basically, like, four-page stories are in here. So, like, the first one's sort of, like, people calling forth, like, a Cthulhu-like being and everything. So you're like, ah, this is real serious. I'll spoil this one for you. But it's just sort of a gag they're playing on him. Like, they call him forth, and then they leave a little, like, poop bag for him to accidentally step on.
Nice.
So it takes a humorous direction. Some of them are sort of like that, and then some are more like Narnia or, you know, different things. Oh, and there's one in here where a guy is pissing, which fills the indie quotient of characters doing that often.
Is this a color, black and white?
Yeah, it's color.
Okay, and so they're mostly, you're saying like four. You're saying they're like four-page-ish stories. How's the flow? Does it flow well, like the humor and then serious and then or all humor? How did you feel it went from story to story?
I'm finding it's pretty good. Like, there's not any like weird things you're like, oh, that could have used more time. Like, they're trying to get to a gag or to a moment or whatever.
And are there any names we would particularly reckon, like some hidden superstars in there?
I don't think you... I don't know any of these people, and I don't think you would know any of these people either.
Whoa, look at the shade he's casted on me, Super Steve. They're people I wouldn't know.
You wouldn't want to know these people, Andrew.
Oh, I think they had the Cthulhu story. Like, they sort of had these stands, and they sort of had the book open to two pages. And I think that one of the two pages they had it open to was the Cthulhu story, which... I think is probably the one you want to have it open to because it's more of an interesting style and you know if something more familiar to certain people and then it's colored differently than the other ones. Like some of the styles are more cartoonish or more stripped down. That I think that was the one that drew me in initially. And then some of the other ones are like animation. So all in all, an interesting time.
Sounds good. Super Steve, do you want to pick up the baton?
Sure. Read a few number ones. One of them is from Top Cow. And it is a... I'm not sure if it's a sequel to a previous series. If it's a Top Cow book, of course, it was written by Matt Hawkins. And Brian Hill with art by Raphael Anko, whose art I really like.
What about Silvestri, Steve? Doesn't he still hang out there?
Write stuff? I think Hawkins has been writing everything since like the late 90s. Occasionally they let Ron Mars write something, but anyway. It's Postal Deliverance, and I'm not sure if there was a postal related to this story that existed prior to this, if this is a sequel or not, but it just came out recently. And like I said, the writer's Brian Hill, artist Raphael Ianco, and created by Matt Hawkins. And the art is great because I like Ianco's work. And it follows the story of, you don't know if he's an agent, like a spy or a criminal or some sort of soldier or a commando of some kind, but there's a guy who's being chased down by a squad of like uniformed personnel, and he's running with a gun and he's shooting them and he's on the run and they're trying to take him out, and you find out that he's running home to try to protect his family, and when he gets there, they're all killed, presumably by this same squad of I don't know if they're good guys or bad guys, or he's the good guy or the bad guy, or I don't know. But we next pick up in a remote middle America type town where you're introduced to the mayor and his wife, who seems like she's the sheriff, and he's got troubles of his own at home a little bit that I'm sure are going to be embellished as the series goes on, but you kind of see what his deal is. And then she comments that there's a new person coming to town and he's got to go meet him. And we jump to that scene, and this mayor fellow is meeting the guy who we just saw and his family died and everything. And he's says, "Welcome to town," the mayor, and the town is called Eden. And he's like, "Hey, listen, I heard about what happened to your wife and family. I'm really sorry that you had to go through that, but don't be bringing any anger into this town. And there's a lot of rules we have here, and you got to follow them." And so it seems like this town is almost like a place people can go to erase themselves and hide if they have some kind of crazy violent past or something, because the guy whose family died, he's brings a whole duffel bag full of money. And like, that's his ticket into town. And the mayor lets him know that he starts out getting a trailer and he's not supposed to come into town until he, you know, passes some sort of tests or loyalty or time passes or whatever. But this guy doesn't listen to the directions and he goes into town and has a drink and gets bumped into by another guy who's spouting some weird stuff about how he like sliced everybody up before he came to here to this town. And they end up getting like the back and forth escalates and they get into a bar fight, and people are like, whoa, you guys can't fight, there's no fighting here, you guys know the rules, you know, they're again with the rules of this secluded town here. But this guy, the guy whose family died, he picks up a broken bottle and slices the guy's throat, and there's all cursing and blood and guts throughout this. And he holds up a glass after ripping out the guy's throat with a broken bottle and says, like, "Hey, I broke the rules. I'll bet you guys have to go tell somebody, and someone's going to be here soon to talk to me about this or whatever. But I'm here to tell you that the rules are about to change in this town." And that's how it kind of ends. And it's like, oh, well, that's interesting. Here's a X-factor dynamic being thrown into this perfectly run, you know, situation that is probably really symbiotic. The people who are running it probably need it to be this way, and the people who live there probably need their anonymity and privacy and everything. And this guy shows up and is, you know, a murderer already, or a bar fight and a death. So it seems really engaging. You guys know when I'm that I'm usually a tough customer for a whole new series and characters and all that sort of stuff. Not that there's not great stuff out there, but gosh, how many new things can a guy take when I also enjoy picking up the stuff that I follow? And, you know, there's only so much time in the day, right? But you guys also know that I really like when, you know, if you want to get me quick, start off with one or two characters and make something happen and engage me right away. And that's just what happened here. The pacing is really good and the art's fantastic. So I'm definitely going to check it out and see if there's another, I think there was another postal thing, but I don't know. Was it related to this? Do we learn what this guy's deal was before that? I don't know. But I'm definitely going to check it out and check out the rest of this series.
Yeah, I don't think we've had Top Cow chatter since Switchblade, maybe. Well, they did that reboot maybe a couple years ago. I don't remember which episode, but I know I bought it. We talked a little bit about the... I mean, that title's been rebooted a few times, but it was fun. Always fun to see a new take on an old character, and this sounds good. I always like it when those little imprints have a good title coming out. You know, you want to see not just good comics, but good comics from different sources.
Is that the home of, like, Sunstone and all those books?
I believe it is. Honestly, in the last, I mean, unless it's been a Ron Mars book, there's not been a lot out of, I didn't expect much from a Top Cow book, but the cover was engaging of just an axe stuck in a tree stump. The Ianco art, I really, that's a easy thing for me to get into right there. So I thought I would check out the first issue, and I was pleasantly surprised.
The best kind of surprise of all. Well, I had a pretty cool surprise. I wanted to give a special thank you. I received a random thing in the mail from a creator you've talked about, Steve, Jim Whiting.
Oh, cool.
Whiting? I don't know how you say Whiting. His name. Whiting. He sent me a couple of comics, and including Margo Intergalactic Trash Collector. Now, you had talked about issues 1 and 2 back on Indie 406 in May of 2018. I don't know if you know if this is the same series or like the next version, but it's easily pick upable. Like, you don't need to know anything ahead of time. Like, it throws you right in, establishes the characters. And I would suggest listeners go back to listen to that episode if you want a more in-depth cover. But I really liked it. I really like that the colors are very fun and engaging and help push the story forward. Margot is an impetuous, she's in the family business, which is intergalactic trash collecting. So, but the vehicles are all kind of junkers. So it's that classic kind of,
don't you like,
Indiana Jones, Star Wars is the one that for me put that idea on the map of like,
sure.
In the future. Like, there's not just shiny spaceships, there's also kind of clunkers that you're always fixing.
I love that.
And she's also kind of young and impetuous, which also is fun. So while she's take charge, she's also going to do crazy things. So this opening issue has her deciding to take a break from her job and go party. And that leads to unfortunate incidents that she has to mixes it up with these characters in a bar. I mean, it's perfect space stuff, you know, big bar fight. And there are some insinuated going behind the scenes of her company, but the first issue doesn't get into it. But yeah, you meet the character. Like you said, it's pretty simple. It's basically Margot. She has like a robot AI type thing that helps run the ship, but it's mainly focused on her. And then they introduce these bad guys and she runs into a third party that may or may not be bad. So it keeps it pretty tight. Whiting's, it's really fun. And like I said, the story moves. And I think for me, it was a color thing, which I know is a weird thing to focus on. But it just was one of those, like, I like brightly colored kind of comics that move. And a lot happens in the first issue. So if I see issue 2, I will definitely pick it up. Because I enjoyed issue 1. And that's, you know, all I can say. I didn't see it recently. I don't know when. He said these issues will be coming out. I don't know, you know. I don't read previews or anything, so.
He had self-published through Kickstarters 3 issues of Margot, and now he's putting them out through Fantico, which was my old LCS back when I was a 10-year-old back in 1980, in the late 70s and early 80s. And they got into horror publishing in the 80s with Gore Shriek was one of their popular titles. And Steve Bissett worked with them and stuff. And they previously to that, they had published collections of Fred Hembeck's material from Comics Journal that was the first time I had ever come across those wonderful albums, and the Chronicles series that were like fanzines of different Marvel characters, but with these gorgeous wraparound covers by like the top industry pros, and they would have some really nice pinups inside by John Byrne and different people. They were really good titles. Fantico's an interesting company. They ended up really getting more notoriety from the horror stuff, and they had some Fantico like horror conventions that are still kind of remembered fondly and nostalgically by people who are in the horror genre fans. But they've been publishing stuff recently, some books and some comics, and Jim has been helping them with that initiative and providing them with content, and then getting to have his books republished and put out through Previews. So this is the first time they've been available to the masses other than through the Whitting Studio storefront.
Yeah, it's just that's like I was saying earlier, I love how comics, once they're done, they're out there and they can exist and new people can get their hands on them. And it just makes it. We also threw in a copy of Infinite Punishment, Shadows of War, number one. And this has Marcelo Traum is created artwork, writing, and also Garrett Gunn and Jim Whitting worked on it as far as the writing credits. And this is one of those grayscale books. Reminds me a lot of the Action Lab mature line. I mean, there's not nudity, but it's like a sexy demon lady. So, you know, in the bikini with the boots and like the sexy poses when they're fighting and all that stuff, which is fun. Like, it's I enjoy that stuff. It's not really my genre, but if that's your thing, like I said, I could totally see this coming out from them. I do enjoy the grayscale because oftentimes they use the tone. I mean, I'm sure it's not Zippitone anymore, but whatever the computer tone is. And, you know, it's fun looking at sexy demon ladies, you know, with, like I said, the high heel boots and bikinis, and are always in like weird poses that may not be fight accurate. But they're escaping from hell. And at the meantime, as a prank, a couple of kids are putting this rich kid through a ritual that's going to end up summoning her to our plane. But like I said, it's more, I think, that appeal of like, if you like go, and it's, I think they're well of that genre. I'm not versed, but I think they're, you know, I think it's very well done for that sort of thing. Like, the lady looks like a sexy demon lady. Like, isn't that the point of that? And so I enjoyed it, but it's not, I mean, occasionally I pick up those comics for fun, but they never seem to hook me in the same sort of way the other ones do. But there's nothing wrong with it, just not to my taste currently.
Well, there has to be, for those types of that genre to work for me, there has to be a stronger storytelling component to it.
And, yes.
But I like Traum's art quite a bit. So yeah. I had fun gazing at the pages.
Yes. Yes. So if you more want, like I said, the lady in some crazy poses. There are a few of these. It's a good thing she has clothes on. What few clothes she has there are strategically placed. But comics have a rich tradition of that I love. That's what makes comics fun. I know some people, right? Like I said, it's not my thing, but it's just a fun part of comics, the sexy girls and sexy poses part, even when they're demons. And you think demons would not be sexy, but...
And the anatomical exaggerations of an artist that makes an artist unique. I mean, that's part of the fun, is like, where do you make your distortions? Not everybody's a John Buscema and is trying to, you know, draw an anatomically correct, especially in this day and age. We get to see some of that more kinetic type anatomy and stuff, and we get to see where people choose to do their distortions and not. And like, there's the J. Scott Campbell type of thing. There's no body that's built that way, but it looks terrific. I love that stuff.
We might have to agree to disagree on that, Steve. Well, I know we get our age old J. Scott. I feel like he's changed. I feel like his older stuff had more composition, more Like, I feel like he put more into it, and maybe I'm being cynical or not fair, but I feel like some of these are just kind of like the same, you know, they just change the hair color or whatever.
But it's still... Like
before, there was a thought about where it was going.
But it's still only in comics can you have those types of distortions and play around with it. And similarly, you know, it's like if you're comics, let's do what comics can do that nobody else can, right? I mean, that's part of the fun. And the same thing you were saying before about appreciating the colors. Me too. I really liked Jim's choices of colors throughout this whole series. And it's that's what, I mean, you should look at comics and be like, well, they could never, how could you do this on the big screen? It could never, you'd have to make everybody in black leather. And that's fun. That's because you can't be like this. This is comics, you know, only in comics can you put those bold colors next to each other and have everything pop and have that bubblegum purple color. Man, I love that stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, it really, and it fits the story. It's like, remnant. That's why I think, not that the art is that way, but sort of like the Fifth Element movie tried to do that, I feel like, where they tried a lot of colors and different things. And I don't know that movie succeeded, but that's what it reminds me of. Like, why, you're a space thing. Like, have crazy colors. Like, they're not right. going to be muted all the time like the modern movies are, which are fun, but, like, you're right, they're all in black leather or whatever.
And for a comic about trash collecting, it's not like it's full of muted browns and yes. rusty colors, you know, which is great.
No, that would be... Well, that would also convey... Like, the color also instantly tells you a bit about the tone, too. This is going to be fun. It's going to... Like, yes. it's not the grim where she's working a dead-end job and going to kill herself at the end or whatever. You know, it's not... That would be the one with all the grays and the blacks or... You know, like the futility of life is going like it. And that's a comic out there, but that's not this one. So
thank goodness.
But I just wanted to say it was very cool to get actual comics in the mail that I wasn't expecting. Because I thought it was just some Kickstarter or whatever. And then you're like, whoa, unsolicited comics.
Kevin, what else have you read?
I have another one for Shortbox. The previous one was that Stokoe one.
Uh-huh.
So this one's Beneath the Dead Oak Tree by Emily Carroll.
Hmm.
Some, like, anamorphic foxes, I guess?
The editor of Shortbox, I think I'm following on Twitter.
Oh.
Or someone involved with the publisher. But I don't see their books anywhere. So I'm glad you get to talk about them.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, some of this stuff, what does it say? Like, I guess it could have been the publisher just... Oh, it says printed in the UK, so... But then the creator is Canadian, so... I'm not quite sure where...
Sounds like tax fraud, is it? Is it?
I don't know where that leaves them, but at TCAF, you know, it could be anything, right? So this is about... I guess 3/4 the size of a regular comic. Like, it's not as wide, not as tall. I mean, it's almost as wide, but not almost as tall. And this is kind of, I guess you could say, like, maybe a romance, more like. It's weird, because you think it's going to be one thing, and then there's, like, a horrible, bloody murder, and you're just like, ooh. Like, there's some shocking parts. And it also has, like, the narration is sort of combined with, like, the characters talking as some weird, like, lyrical rhyme poetry. Like, it doesn't always match up, but more often than not, like, their words are playing off of each other. Which I thought is different than most comics I usually read. And the artwork, it's like one of those things where there's so much detail... And some of the details obscured. Like, I feel like if this was an artist edition size, or I need this in a bigger size. Because there's, like, this big party going on, and all these people in all these elaborate robes and costumes. Like, think of, I don't know, like, England. It's, like, the 17th century or something. And everyone has, like, there's cathedrals and, like, all this stuff. but some of the chandeliers and everything are like hanging, are drawn in like it's in white, but it hangs over some of the illustration, and all like if they're not the main characters, they're all colored as one, and only the main characters like you can they're the focal point. But there's so much detail on the costumes and, like, the hair and the jewelry and everything. You can't, like, I can't see. I want to see, I want to examine this detail, like, way close up. So I need, like, a bumped up copy that's many times bigger because I want to check this out. It's just hard to see sometimes. I'm like, well, what's going on there? What is that? Which is pretty awesome.
Cool.
So yeah, I would definitely recommend this. It's not quite what I expected, but thoroughly entertaining. And that crazy artwork.
I like that Kevin's putting the indie in indie, Steve. We're talking Image and Top Cow and all that corporate nonsense, and Kevin's really representing.
Well, I've done my whole Valiant and Deathmate and Image
and Black Hammer.
Yeah, yeah, run through.
Those are your corporate comics.
I know, you got to bring it back to what it's all about, right, Andrew?
Exactly. Got weirdos making their own comics and printing them themselves. No, Shortbox, yeah, haven't seen them, but I've seen them online. I just haven't seen a show where they're posting.
Well, if they're ever at a show you're at, pick up some of their stuff.
I will. Maybe if they come, I don't know if they're going to come to Comic Arts LA or not. That show might be too little for them. I don't know.
Yeah, that's the show. I think some of the people that have been, I think, at TCAF or other related shows sometimes show up. So.
Yeah, sometimes that's the one where I get the most hostility. So it'll be another foyer into an unsafe space for Andy, but. These are the things that I do for you people. Super Steve, do you want to slake your thirst?
I have another number one that's from an obscure little company called Image.
Oh, way to bring it home, Steve.
Their Skybound imprint, actually. It is written by Justin Jordan with art by Rebecca Isaacs, and it's called Reaver.
Wait, so did they put, like, based on an idea by Hickman or something like that on it somewhere?
Nope. And it is a very colorful, very well-drawn book. It's engaging right away. It is like a medieval times type scenario, but people are frequently using modern curse words and stuff. So, you know, they start off with a battlefield. There's two big armies fighting each other with swords and picks and shields and armor on and horseback riding and everything. And they're yelling, you know, as the guys are getting stabbed or their limbs are getting chopped off, they're yelling like, oh, fuck. And you son of a bitch, take this, that kind of stuff. And this army is getting kind of shoehorned and they're trying to figure out their next move. And it kind of focuses on the commander and one other guy who's with him, and they're kind of trying to travel together here to figure out what they're going to do next. And a guy who's supposed to be on their side, this oversized, multi-weaponed, heavily armored berserker, has lived up to his namesake, and he's gone berserk. It's like the Dungeons and Dragons chaos role that you don't want to get, and like the guy starts attacking his own party. And that's just what happens. And he's just chopping guys left and right in half and disemboweling people. And he chops off the arm of the commander that the other fellow is holding his hand of because he's trying to lift him out of this ditch. And the guy gets caught and
he's just running from the commander and running away from this berserker, and the berserker steps on his back and his eyeballs are like popping out of his head and everything, and he's just runs, leaves this guy to die there and everybody else on the battlefield. And then we get a fast forward to, I guess, the king or the commander of one of the armies who was in battle, and he is looking at the big picture, trying to figure out how he's going to move his troops around and whatever. And he's got a sniveling magician type advisor who has that Loki look that, you know, this guy is up to no good, regardless of what he says. He's speaking with a forked tongue, and he's convinced this commander that he needs to send a task force to this remote location to gather men or enlightenment or knowledge or spells or whatever to turn the tide in this war. So it is becomes the issue becomes a assembling the team situation. And that's fun. The first guy is the guy who ran from the battlefield that we were introduced to in the opening scene. And then there's a couple of other people who join in, each with their own qualities. Gets this very Dungeons and Dragons-y, or what I was thinking was this is very like movie Conan-ish, where Schwarzenegger's gathering his little crew of people to go on the grand adventure, because it's like a sword and sorcery type of environment. And the interesting addition to the task force is the berserker, the one who went berserk on that battlefield. So he's on the same, you know, fellowship of adventurers here as the guy who ran from him on that battlefield. So that creates an interesting dynamic there. And it has this Dirty Dozen element too, where it's they're being sent on this suicide mission. They gathered up a bunch of the people they had in their cages in their cells, and they're going to send them off on this impossible mission. And much to my delight, when I got to the end of the issue, there is a text piece by Justin Jordan, and he says my inspiration was really like movie Conan the Barbarian and the Dirty Dozen. I'm yeah. like, yes, that's just what I was thinking as I was reading this thing. And he goes on to talk about how he wants the world, or he thinks that it's a fun, challenging world when there's just like low magic, that like there's not big spells, but there's like little spells that different people wield. And I think it should be a fun adventure. The sly potential mage advisor guy is going with them on this mission, so I have a feeling he wants to get somewhere to gain some sort of advantage or some sort of, you know, to level up himself somehow. But the colors and the line work were really good. The storytelling was real fun. Slowly introduced to another character and another character and another character. It totally worked for me. And then on the last couple of pages, you get to see the place that they're trying to get to and the big bad that's there. And, admits that he knows that they're coming. So it should be fun.
Sounds like it. All right. I think we're reaching a good indie level. Does anyone have any final thoughts before we wrap this one up?
Cobra next episode, Andrew?
Don't know about that.
What?
Maybe. No. We'll see.
Wow.
We're not making any decisions. That's the next episode could be in a month from now. So let's
I'm coming back. It's going to be two episodes in a row. I got to see how this pans out.
Oh, don't make promises, Steve.
Yeah. All right, guys. Well, thanks everyone for listening, and we hope you will turn back in next time to see what we're up to.
Later.
Working on a piece that speaks of sex and desperation. I've been screwing on the tracks of abandoned train stations.